Natalia entered the ballroom, and the music should have stopped. Rourke's heart nearly did. She walked at Paul's right, Annie, beautiful as well, at Paul's left. Both women wore black. A short distance behind them walked Michael, his mother at his left arm, Maria Lloyden at his right. Sarah's pregnancy was barely detectable with the dark blue floor-length gown she wore. And Maria Lloyden, her glasses absent, her hair up, wore a floor-length, bare-shouldered dress of pale green. John walked across the ballroom floor, threading his way past the dancing couples, straight to Sarah. She looked up at him.
Dance with me?
She came into his arms as he drew her out onto the floor.
You're beautiful.
She leaned her head against his chest for a moment.
I understand we're supposed to drink and dance and have a good time for a while yet until the banquet. And more drinking and dancing and having a good time.
You're getting a medal, John.
Yeah. That young officer, Hammerschmidt's brother, he deserves a medal. Darkwood deserves a medal.
I hear he'll get one once he returns to Midwake. And he's getting one here tonight.
Rourke looked down into his wife's gray-green eyes.
Oh. Is there anything else happening this evening I don't know about?
It depends, John.
Rourke smiled and drew her close against him.
I am empowered to offer half of all territories to be conquered and our full logistical support, technological and otherwise, in your reclamation efforts associated with these lands. All of this in exchange for your full cooperation in prosecution of the war effort against the Allies, and your turning over to us 10% of your submarine fleet, plus whatever Midwake vessels might be captured, with, of course, your full support for our successful operation of these vessels.
The head of the Triumvirate smiled and folded his hands on the conference table.
10% of our fleet? The Midwake vessels are yours, but this 10%...
I can assure you, comrade, that your forces would be more than compensated. You would have full right to all armored vehicles and surface weapons technology captured from the Allies, as well as 10% of our armor, to include the mobile missile launchers we discussed earlier.
And the particle beam weapons technology, comrade general. Would you share this with us?
I am not authorized to do so, comrade. But such details as these would be open to discussion in the future. We should, of course, be prepared to share with you our nuclear warheads.
Antonovich smiled.
But following a victory over the Allies, comrade, of what use would such devices be to either of us? And, as I have said, if we use these missiles during the conflict, we will all suffer the consequences. The nuclear missiles figure into our overall strategic plans as a sort of Damocles only.
A sort of what?
Svetlana Alexova smiled.
In the mythology of an ancient land known as Greece, a sword was suspended over a man's head on a single thread. If the thread broke, the sword would fall and kill him. If it did not, he was spared.
Then, under no circumstances... would we use our nuclear missiles?
We would be committing planetary suicide, comrades, were we to do that. But the Germans and Americans at Midwake will believe that we will use them if necessary, therefore holding back.
Does not your intelligence suggest that the Germans are perfecting nuclear capabilities?
Yes, but...
if they are sufficiently far along... not only can these missiles be used against land-based targets, but also against ourselves here beneath the sea. It would not be difficult for the submarine vessel captured by the war criminal Darkwood, which has a full complement of missiles armed with conventional warheads, to be turned to our destruction merely by using the German warhead.
It is not my fault, Comrade Admiral, that one of your submarines was stolen. But the likelihood of such a development in time for it to be of any consequence against us is highly remote.
Antonovich lit another cigarette.
If we strike now, your vessels will catch the German defenses by surprise. My land forces will attack. We could achieve a major victory. At the very least, we will so severely weaken our adversaries that they will never fully recover. The Allies, without a manufacturing base in New Germany or in Midwake, would be powerless to resupply. A full company of elite corps commandos stand ready to join with your Marine Spetsnaz personnel in an assault on Midwake. If we can severely damage both technological centers, New Germany and Midwick, victory is ours.
And what do you say, Comrade Dr. Alexova?
Antonovich stared at Svetlana Alexova, then at the triumvirate head.
Why do you ask?
I have curiosity for the scientific perspective, Comrade General.
Svetlana Alexova folded her hands at the very edge of the table and looked at Antonovich for a split second over the rims of her glasses.
All that General Antonovich says is true, comrade, of course. But the argument that the atmospheric envelope would be irreparably damaged by one or even a few nuclear detonations is theory at best, based on computer models. Indeed...
Svetlana!
Indeed, the particle beam technology may be sufficient to defeat the Allied land forces and allow total concentration, then, on the forces of your historic American enemies at Midwick. But should the energy weapons, which were developed...
She removed her glasses and smiled.
Under my direction, should they prove inadequate to the task, then we must be militarily and psychologically prepared, comrades, to use the warheads.
Antonovich stood there, wanting to say something, but not knowing what. She looked up at him.
I speak on full authority of our government.
What are you?
She smiled at him, cocking her eyebrows.
A realist, comrade? I did not endure the nuclear war in the era from which you survived. Therefore, perhaps I have a clearer perspective, can view the events unfolding before us with a degree of objectivity greater than yours, comrade. If the Allied forces on the surface are vaporized, what does it matter so long as communism triumphs?
What does it matter? Are you insane? We would all die because the planet would no longer be capable of supporting human life. Any life.
Speculation. Only speculation.
Antonovich sat down heavily in his chair.
I will order the commander of our fleet stationed off the coast of Argentina to await coordinates from your forces so the missile bombardment of New Germany can begin in coordination with your surface attack.
Antonovich heard the words but did not look at the man. He looked at Svetlana Alexova's eyes. He saw madness there. The head table, set on a long dais, overlooked a sea of round dinner tables covered with white tablecloths and elegant dinners. Seated eight to a table, the German officer corps and government functionaries seemed out in full strength.
Who's minding the front?
In addition to the Germans and their spouses, there were quite a number of unaccompanied officers from Midwake and some from the first Chinese city. John recognized many among both officer corps. Bjorn Rolvag was the only representative from Iceland. Rourke and his family sat at the head table, along with Jason Darkwood, Sam Aldridge, Otto Hammerschmidt, and Hammerschmidt's younger brother. Wolfgang Mann ascended to the podium.
We are here tonight to pay honor to several brave men, two of them American, and one of them German. Though we specifically honor these three men, we honor all men and women tonight who so cherish freedom that they willingly risk their lives. We sit here tonight knowing that at any moment, our units might be called up in the event of an attack by the Soviet forces who have penetrated New Germany. Off our shore lie the undersea boats of still a second Soviet power.
A murmur spread through the audience. Senior and junior officers passed hurried looks to one another.
Most symbolic of our fight is one man. His name is Dr. John Thomas Rourke.
Rourke looked down into his drink.
The good doctor is indeed the rallying point, the focus of our fight. Without his help, those of us who are citizens of New Germany would still be living beneath the heel of a tyrant leader who espoused the vile philosophy of Nazism, suppressing all free thought. Those of us here tonight from the first Chinese city might well have been crushed by the Soviet war machine had it not been for Dr. Rourke's courageous leadership in preventing the Soviets from obtaining the nuclear missiles of the second Chinese city. Indeed, all of us might have suffered, died. Tonight, we are honored by the presence of one of the heroic people of Iceland, a humble officer of the law. Litverdeed Island, too, owes its debts to John Rourke. Let us not forget Midwake. The last bastion of the United States of America, a city beneath the waters of the Pacific, which for five centuries has single-handedly and heroically battled the Soviet Communist war machine. Here, too, John Rourke played an important role. John Thomas Rourke. Though all assembled here tonight know his name as well as their own, not all of us know very much more about him. I conferred with his heroic wife, Sarah, with his son and his daughter and his friends. I will share with you some of what I have learned.
Rourke wanted to escape. There was nowhere to run.
John Thomas Rourke was born during what was known as the Cold War, the only child of an American agent who fought against Germany during World War II. John trained to become a physician, but after completion of medical training, he joined the United States Intelligence Organization, known as the CIA, or Central Intelligence Agency. During those years, he fought against the forces of communism in our very own South America and elsewhere throughout the globe. The doctor left the CIA to teach and write. Peaceful pursuits, one might say. But for John Rourke, there was no peace, as long as there was injustice. He taught survivalism, taught weapons use, taught counter-terrorist tactics. He lectured widely, and to quote the good doctor himself, he planned ahead. Despite the periodic warmings and coolings in relations between the United States and the Soviet Union, John Rourke used all of his income, not necessary for the immediate maintenance of his family, to construct and stock a survival retreat in the mountains of Georgia, then one of the 48 contiguous states of the United States of America. However, when the exchange of nuclear warheads took place that fatal night of the war, Dr. Rourke was separated from his family. In the intervening period between that night of terror and the dawn when the skies turned to fire, not only did Dr. Rourke locate his family and get them to safety, but he also foiled a plot by renegade forces within the Soviet government to become the only survivors on the planet, to destroy the returning spaceships of the Eden Project, and become masters of a desolated Earth. When, after 5 centuries of cryogenic sleep, the Rourke family emerged from the retreat, there was more work to be done, and John Thomas Rourke did not shirk, did not say enough. Again, he risked all for freedom. Tonight, he honors us with his presence. We intend to honor him with our highest decoration, but the two honors cannot be compared.
Could nothing save John from this? Colonel Mann stepped aside and Dieter Bern returned to the podium.
Dr. John Rourke.
Rourke sat in his seat, Sarah on one side of him, Natalia on the other. Sarah prodded him.
Go on. John, don't be bashful.
Rourke stood, buttoned his coat, and walked to the podium.
On behalf of a grateful new Germany, and, dare I say, on behalf of freedom-loving men and women of this planet, I present you with our highest honor, the Knight's Cross.
Dieter Bern placed the medal's ribbon around John's neck. Everyone in the hall rose to their feet. John looked daggers at his friend Paul. The applause continued. Rourke looked from side to side. For once in his life, he prayed to be rescued. Help was not on the horizon. John stepped forward and faced the crowd. The applause thundered on.
I'd like to...
Rourke raised his arms, the palms of his hands outward. The applause trickled off. The men and women sat down.
As you may have detected, I'm feeling a bit uncomfortable this evening.
John looked at Paul and Michael as they laughed. He smiled, shook his head, then went on.
My family, apparently, is enjoying my discomfort. I've never been someone shy about public speaking, but I've never really been someone who felt he deserved an honor such as this, so you'll have to forgive my halting attempts at thanks. Thank you on behalf of myself, my family, on behalf of all those who died fighting for the cause all of us here believe in. Freedom.
John Rourke left the podium. Rourke seated himself. Sarah and Natalia stood on either side of him, applauding. Annie leaned over and kissed him. Paul and Michael shook his hand. Sarah looked at Natalia.
Kiss him. I'm going to.
Simultaneously, both women kissed him. John grabbed for the women, Natalia's head pressed against his chest, Sarah's body hugged against him as he shielded them both. Portions of the walls were collapsing, and part of the ceiling was falling down. That was the last Natalia saw as John pulled her and Sarah beneath the table, still shielding them with his body. Her first thought was that one of the Soviet submarine-launched missiles had struck the mountain. But if it had been nuclear, they would have been vaporized. Or if it had not been a direct hit, more of the structure would have been collapsing. It must be conventional explosives, which meant it was not a missile at all. A conventional warhead couldn't reach them this deep in the mountain, the center of New Germany's civilization. They were under attack from the inside.
It's not the Soviets! It's a damn Nazi!
Natalia tugged away from John and crawled along the plaster-dusted floor, her beautiful new black dress already covered with dirt. She closed her eyes, shaking her head to get some of the plaster dust out of her hair. She found what she was searching for on the floor and opened her evening bag. Crammed inside it was the Walther PPKS, a spare magazine, and the suppressor. She twirled the suppressor onto the PPKS and slipped the spare magazine down the front of her dress. Natalia peered beneath the tablecloth. A dozen men, at least, in black commando gear with swastika armbands moved through the hall, indiscriminately spraying every table.
Bastards!
She looked to her right. John was already in motion, the little snub-nosed .38 revolver he'd picked up at the retreat in his right hand. Beside her, she felt a familiar presence.
Any good ideas, Michael?
There was one of his Beretta 92Fs in his left hand.
Yeah, I guess. Let's go.
As she got to a crouch beside him, she could already see Annie and Paul, guns drawn, moving off the side of the platform at the far end of the speaker's table. So far, they moved undetected. Side by side with Michael, she edged back toward the near end of the table. Many of the round tables were overturned, officers sheltering their spouses behind them. Those apparent few who carried arms returned fire, but with little or no effect.
Let's get him!
With only the little revolver in his hand, he was running toward them. She knew then the meaning of the expression about one's heart leaping to one's throat. Rourke found the nearest of the Nazi attackers, a man close to his own size, carrying an M16 like all the others he was able to see.
God.
It was the power-mad Eden Project commander who must be responsible for arming these men. Natalia told him the arms used during the attempt made on her life and Annie's could only have come from the Eden Project stores. Rourke advanced. As the black-clad Nazi assassin he targeted made to fire on another group of defenseless people, Rourke stepped away from the wall.
Hey!
Darkwood came up in the edge of Rourke's peripheral vision, weaponless.
Grab that M16.
Rourke dodged left, four shots remaining in the little revolver, a single speed loader with five more rounds in an outside pocket of his tuxedo. There was pistol fire from the opposite wall. Rourke looked to see Annie and Paul engaging two of the attackers. More ceiling debris fell around him. Rourke looked upward for an instant. He realized the ceiling was about to completely collapse. More of the Nazis entered through the doors to the hall, but some of the German officers were now armed. Fighting churned everywhere. Rourke reached around his back under his coat, jerking the little A.G. Russell knife free of its sheath. The Centennial in his right fist, the pear-shaped boot knife in his left, he waded into the Nazis. John dropped an M16-wielding Nazi with a shot to the temple. Then he wrenched the rifle away before its owner hit the ground. Rourke reached the doorway. A knot of Nazi personnel just on the other side were pinned down there by three German officers with captured M16s, along with Sam Aldridge. John looked back into the banquet hall. Bjorn Rolvag, his expression almost placid, beat three of the Nazis back toward a wall with nothing more than a chair. One of the Nazis tried to raise his weapon. Rolvag smashed the chair over the man's face, then waded in on the other two men, hammering them down with his fists. Jason Darkwood was at the doorway now. With him, Otto Hammerschmidt. A heavy volume of fire poured through the doorway from the Nazis stalled outside. A stalemate, and once more, Rourke looked to the ceiling. More and more plaster rained down, and the crack he noticed seconds ago was growing. Sarah, a bloody steak knife in her right hand and A.G. Russell knife in the other, moved through the room, inspecting the dead and injured. Rourke tucked back closer to the wall near the door.
Keep away from the opening!
Inside the hall, those who could drew back. Darkwood fought on the other side of the doorway.
Colonel Mann took three men with him and went out through the kitchen to get behind them and, what's the term, Sam?
An envelopment!
Yeah, he said give him about 2 minutes. I make it he's got a minute to go.
Rourke looked at the ceiling again.
Maybe we do it for lucky, Sam. Get people organized to evacuate the wounded, fast.
Yes, sir.
Hammerschmidt, help him. Get Rolvag with you.
Rourke shook his head, looking at Michael, Paul, Annie, and Natalia.
Annie, Natalia, help Sarah and Maria with the injured. If someone looks too hopeless to get out, it's going to be a judgment call.
I will make it.
Rourke nodded as the women moved off.
Michael, Paul, Jason. Get us six more people who are armed and hurry up!
Rourke checked the M16. 8 rounds remained in the magazine.
I need magazine!
He let the M16 fall to his side on its sling and took the revolver from the pocket of the ruined tuxedo. He pushed the cylinder release catch and used his trigger finger, pushing the cylinder out of the frame. He emptied the spent brass onto the plaster-covered floor and dropped in the remaining 5 rounds. The revolver reloaded, he slid it into the front of his waistband. A young German officer ran up, handed him 20-round magazines.
These are all that I could find, General!
Rourke smiled, shook his head, and put one of the 320s up the well of the M16. He kept the one with 8 rounds as a spare, then handed around the other 2 magazines. The ceiling would go at any second.
As soon as we're into the corridor, start evacuating as quickly as possible.
He looked at Michael, Paul, and Jason Darkwood. Darkwood had 6 other men. All 9 were armed with M16s. Paul had his Browning high power in his left hand, the hammer down.
You and you! You understand enough English? Good! I want suppressive fire on the Nazi position!
Han Lu Chen, the Chinese intelligence agent from the first city, approached, M16 in hand. Rourke nodded to him, then continued.
Nice controlled burst, firing high and low, alternating so they'll think there are more than just 2 of you. Keep firing until you've each fired 3 bursts, then cease firing until we're through the doors and on them. Then join us, right?
Yes, General.
Take up your position. Paul, Michael, stick with me. You too, Han. Jason, take the rest of them.
Yes, Herr General.
Blow it out your rear!
Flanking the door on either side, the 2 young Germans who were to provide the suppressive fire were in position. In almost perfect synchronization, the 2 officers opened fire, neat 3- and 4-round bursts in a crossfire pattern against the Nazi position beyond the large double doors of the banquet hall. The ceiling above John Rourke groaned, about to collapse. The German officers snapped their rifles up.
Charge!
The Nazis were positioned just inside the doors of the dance hall, the room still brightly lit and decorated with banners featuring both the German and United States colors. John, Paul, and Michael fired their M16s in short full-auto bursts. The 3 men raced through the doorway, leading the crowd of revelers turned commandos into the Nazi force. The floor beneath Rourke's feet shook. A cloud of plaster dust belched across the corridor and through the doors into the ballroom, dense as heavy fog. John held his breath and ran into the corridor, chunks of the ceiling collapsing around him.
Kleinermann! Assistance subduing the enemy personnel in the ballroom! The rest of you to the banquet hall!
Men were everywhere around Rourke, at last penetrating the cloud of dust inside the banquet hall. Enormous chunks of the ceiling lay everywhere. Rourke handed off his rifle. John's skills as a doctor were needed now more than anything else. Sarah assisted one of the German doctors at an aid station set up at the far end of the ballroom, as distant as possible from the still unstable ceiling of the banquet hall and the almost as badly damaged corridor. Natalia, Annie, and Maria helped at another aid station at the far end of the corridor, where there was no evidence of immediate structural damage. Michael, his left arm stiff at his side, the sleeve of his jacket cut away, and a blood-stained bandage over his bicep, joined Rourke and Paul Rubinstein. John, in his shirt sleeves now, the partially loaded Beretta in his trouser band beside the emptied Smith & Wesson revolver, crossed into the corridor once more. Flanked by his son and his friend, he clambered over the debris and toward the center of the banquet hall, where people were still buried alive.
John! I've got one that's alive!
Yeah! Tell Colonel Mann we need those gas masks quickly!
As they reached Darkwood, kneeling atop a pile of debris, Sam Aldridge appeared from inside the mound, his black hair washed gray with dust, his uniform torn.
Got a woman down there, Got a woman down there, Doctor! She's...
Rourke looked at Darkwood.
Jason! You get Sam and yourself out of here. Get some fresh air and stay out of here until we get masks. Make sure they check for filters. Now, get out of here!
Darkwood nodded. He hauled Sam Aldridge's right arm across his shoulder and helped the Marine captain down the mound of debris toward the doors.
Let me go. I'm smaller.
Rourke looked at his friend and nodded. Logic was logic. Paul handed Michael his high power and dropped to his knees, then started into the hole.
I'm coming to help you out of there, ma'am!
John Rourke looked around them as his friend disappeared down inside the hole. The speaker's table, where they all dined less than 15 minutes ago, was all but buried. The dais, on which it once sat, collapsed. The podium lay partially buried on the floor on its side. As far as could be told in these first moments after the disaster, no one he knew more than casually was unaccounted for, but that could change at any moment.
John!
John and Michael leaned over the hole. It was dark inside, and they had no flashlight.
What is it? How is she?
She might have a broken back. I'm not sure.
All right, I'm coming down.
Rourke handed Michael the Beretta.
Here, take this, and this too.
John gave his son the little revolver as well. Rourke's bow tie was already undone, and he ripped it from beneath his collar now. His hands, which were only partially healed, were already cracking and bleeding in spots from the abrasive action of the plaster. He placed one hand on either side of the hole and let himself down. The hole's interior diameter was tight, almost too tight for his shoulders, as he crouched on the floor. He could barely see, and the plaster dust was chokingly thick. John crawled in the dark on hands and knees through the dust and debris toward the sound of Paul's coughing.
John!
In a moment, Rourke was on his knees, stooped over beside Paul Rubenstein. In the poor light, Rourke could make out the woman's gross features, but nothing in detail. Rourke bent over the woman, his hands moving along her body.
Paul, what makes you think...
The woman's body was twisted at the waist at an unnatural angle. She was breathing, but heavily. His hand traveled down her left leg, and he pinched it. There was feeling. With great difficulty, he got his hands beneath her, feeling along her spine.
It's not broken, but she does have broken ribs, and likely there's a fracture in one or both legs, the way they're twisting. You get out of here. Get the Germans to haul in some of that heavy equipment they're promising.
They were saying they weren't certain the floor would take it.
Yeah, but get them to evacuate anything below us in this building. Get a move on with any of the other more easily moved casualties. We'll need that guest list checked and verified for attendance. Once we got a count, then bring in the equipment. In the meantime, I'm going to need oxygen down here for her and a gas mask for myself. Now find one of the other doctors and get him down here for a glucose IV to keep her going until we get her out of here.
All right.
Yeah, I know. You'll be back quickly.
Right.
Paul squeezed past him and was gone. Rourke found the woman's hand, held it, and waited. One of the Nazis was under the doctor's knife. Natalia watched the German doctor's eyes over the rims of his eyeglasses.
The bastard has a bullet so close to his heart. I should not try this.
Natalia looked at him.
If you wait, he will die.
If I try to get that bullet out, he could die too.
That's why they call you a surgeon. What can I do to help?
The young doctor looked at her.
Damn you, Fräulein.
He rolled up his sleeves. Natalia smiled as a thought crossed her mind. In her ruined evening gown, she had no sleeves to roll. Close him, nurse. Sarah hadn't been addressed by that title for 5 centuries. She looked at the doctor she assisted. He was an older man, past retirement age, but his hands were steady when he removed the bullet from the young Chinese officer's neck. He was already turning to the next patient, too, so Sarah had no choice. She began closing the wound. You are very good, Frau Rourke. The old man turned to his new patient. Sarah's back was killing her from standing, even though she kicked off her already low-heeled shoes. She shook her head, keeping at the suturing. John looked into Michael's gas mask-covered face as he helped his father from the hole.
You all right, Dad?
John nodded. His back ached from being bent over for so long, and despite his mask, he still coughed. The blocks and tackle were nearly set. The young German doctor who replaced John a few moments ago was ready.
I am staying down here with her while the hole is opened. I cannot leave her alone.
Rourke looked into the darkness below.
Good man.
It was 4 in the morning, New Germany time, and though John was exhausted, he needed fresh air. The canned air of the city would not suffice. In his plaster-coated black trousers and dirt-stained white shirt, his jacket hooked over his shoulder, and one of the captured Berettas in his waistband, John Rourke left the hospital where he had been working nearly non-stop for the last 6 hours. He saved some lives, but couldn't save others. Such was the physician's lament, and he wondered as he walked whether or not that, as much as other reasons, was why he left medicine in the first place. He wanted to smoke a cigar, wanted to very much, but to smoke would be counterproductive, since the purpose of his walk was to get fresh air. Military personnel patrolled everywhere despite the hour, and latest word indicated that calling up the reserves was warranted and timely. The Soviet submarine fleet was no longer merely on station. It was maneuvering off the coast. Soviet presence in the Falkland Islands, a staging area used by the Soviet forces for the past several weeks, increased by the hour. Rourke neared the main entrance. The enormous blast doors stood closed and secured. He approached the young first lieutenant on guard. The man saluted.
Herr General!
At ease. I'd just like to use the little access door over there and go outside for a breath of fresh air.
But, Herr General, it would be very dangerous to do, and...
Lieutenant, isn't there a considerable presence of the forces of New Germany on the other side of those doors? Armor, infantry, even long-range mountain patrol units?
Well, yes, Herr General, but...
Then how could I be any safer? Open the door and please listen when I knock to return. Should we have a code knock?
I will be able to see you, Herr General, on the video monitoring system.
You see? I'll be safe as church.
As
church. Church, synagogue, temple, mosque. They're all means to the same end.
To the same end, Herr General?
Yeah. I'll pass through that access doorway now, please.
Yes, Herr General.
The young man saluted. Rourke nodded. He followed the man toward the doorway.
Open the door for General Rourke!
Rourke was beginning to worry that his title, embarrassing as it was, might stick. John slipped on his coat. Then, at last, as he stepped over the flange and into the night, he could breathe proper air again. As he filled his lungs, he experienced an almost giddy sensation. It was cool, impossibly fresh, and because of the jungle vegetation so near, heady by comparison to scrubbed air in the mountain city. He looked at his surroundings. German armor and other vehicles stood everywhere at the ready. The German armor was very good, highly mobile, fast, but so vastly smaller than the Soviet armor.
The German machines won't stand much of a chance against their Soviet counterparts.
The battle, which for some time Rourke considered inevitable, was nearly at hand. As a boy, because it was there and deserved to be experienced, he read the Bible in the King James Version. He recalled it now.
And he gathered them together into a place called in the Hebrew tongue Armageddon. Well, time for a cigar.
He pulled one from an interior breast pocket of his coat, the tip already excised, as was his custom. He lit the cigar in the blue-yellow flame of his battered Zippo. He flicked the lighter's cowling closed, then dropped it into his pocket. John walked. Officers passed him, saluted him. Rourke nodded in return. He'd never been a military man, and would not affect that he had. At any moment, the sky would rain death. He knew that. So he enjoyed the moment of quiet and peace, as the exquisitely rare and wonderful thing it was. There might never be another. The air raid sirens did not wake him as much as Sarah's movement in bed beside him.
John?
Rourke sat bolt upright, his right arm around her, his left hand pressed against her abdomen. He kissed her desperately. He let it ring, holding her. Finally, Sarah reached for the phone.
Yes, Wolf. He's here.
Rourke squinted as Sarah turned on the light, and the gray darkness dissolved into a yellow wash.
Colonel.
Rourke looked at the Rolex Submariner on his wrist. He got to bed at 5. It was almost, but not quite, 2 hours later.
The Soviet fleet off our coast has ceased movement. Bombardment seems imminent.
Where can Sarah go for safety?
Oh, John.
Don't argue.
John.
No. Not you, Colonel.
There is a bunker built by the Leiter some years ago. It is several levels underground and well-stocked. Dieter Bern goes there now.
Send a small unit for my wife, my daughter, Dr. Leuden, and Major Chemarovna.
John!
Rourke looked at his wife and held her close.
Where should I join you, Colonel? It'll take me about 5 minutes.
I will send a driver along with the personnel to accompany your wife.
Very good. You'll contact Michael and Paul then. I'll see you shortly.
Rourke handed his wife the telephone receiver. She hung it up.
Go ahead. Tell me how a woman who's pregnant should be out there at the front, wherever the hell that'll be.
John, I love you.
I know.
Rourke drew his wife tight to him. Why wasn't there ever time? He held her, telling himself, as each second passed, just 1 second more. Michael Rourke slipped his feet over the side of the bed and stared at them under the wash of light from the lamp. Maria put her arms around his neck, her face against his back.
I want to be with you, Michael.
You can't.
I won't get in the way.
I didn't say that you'd get in the way, but I just want you safe, that's all.
Oh. Michael tried to stand up, but she held him more tightly.
If you die, I want to die too.
Maria, I'm not going to die.
His left arm ached, felt stiff, and the left cheek of his butt hurt from his recent tetanus antibiotic cocktail injection.
I'll function better knowing that you're safe. Colonel Mann said that Natalia and Annie and my mother would be with you, taken to safety. That's where you belong.
Michael started to dress. There was no time to shower, and John showered less than 2 hours ago anyway, so he merely stood under the water, trying to come fully awake. He'd survived on less sleep, and likely would again. And en route to the coast, he might be able to grab a few winks.
Can I get anything out for you, John?
Yeah, a pair of black BDU pants, one of those black knit pullover shirt, socks, underpants, you know, like that.
Take a sweater?
Sure. Sarah?
Yes?
I love you.
I know that.
Being a woman is perfectly fine, but the way men perceive women sucks.
Annie and Paul dressed hurriedly, as much to respond to the emergency as for Annie to have her hands free to better make her point.
Annie, I can't...
She stepped into a slip and pulled it up to her waist, then looked at him.
It's Daddy, isn't it?
What do you mean?
I should be beside you, and we both know that, but Daddy thinks...
Oh, Annie, for God's sake! I want you with me, but I love you too much to put you into the...
Danger? Oh... Be real, Paul.
Paul finally had his pants up.
I don't...
Know what to say.
She came into his arms, her own arms going around his neck, and kissed him with all her might.
Fine. I love you, and I'll obey you. But the obey part doesn't mean I have to like it, or that I forfeit my right to bitch.
Oh, ho, 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 ho.
He held her as tight as he could.
I can't breathe.
They shared another kiss. John Rourke had the taste of Sarah still on his lips, the feel of her on the flesh of his hands as he opened the apartment's front door. In one of her black jumpsuits, her revolvers buckled to her waist, Natalia Anastasia Tyamarovna just stood there.
This is your doing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I am not someone to be shunted off and...
Yes, you are. If you should die, I...
What, John?
Damn it.
Rourke turned and walked away. Colonel Mann's driver and the security unit that would usher the women to the bunker were already coming up the corridor. John Rourke looked across the landing pad set atop the mountain. Wind lashed men and aircraft with a vicious, nearly human ferocity. Sets of lift tubes were positioned at the four cardinal points, and men of the Allied Commando Force ran from them, heavily laden with weapons and gear, toward their waiting aircraft. Within minutes, the aircraft would be airborne. More aircraft would take their place, and more men would hurry toward them, fill their fuselages, and the process would cycle through again. Rourke had his face turned into the wind, relishing the fresh air. His eyes burned from lack of sleep, and he would need alertness. He turned to the right. The sun was still low on the horizon. Colonel Mann approached, accompanying Jason Darkwood. Rourke massaged his hands as he looked away, then back toward them.
Field intelligence indicates a large Soviet force is positioning itself for attack on the complex, John. We have very little time.
Rourke only nodded.
If we're successful in achieving our objective, Colonel, any Soviet ground attack can be all but neutralized.
And if we're not...
Natalia, perhaps the tight black jumpsuit she wore enhanced the image, Sarah thought, paced like a caged cat. Sarah Rourke looked from Natalia to Annie. Annie stood by the bunker doors, rocking on her boot heels. As she rocked, her skirt swayed in rhythm to her motion, back and forth. Sarah dug her hands into the pockets of her BDU pants and looked down at her body. The BDU blouse was cut full, but she was pregnant. The blouse closures strained to stay together. Sarah walked across the room. It was actually more like a cave. The highest point of the ceiling was perhaps 60 feet overhead, but a mere 12 feet overhead stretched an interlocking network of beams. Similar beams rose from the floor to meet them. The floor served as a platform set over the cave floor. The vertical beams defined the perimeter of the platform. It all resembled a vast proscenium stage. As Sarah reached the nearest of the edges, she looked down. The cave floor lay some 6 feet below. She craned her neck and could just make out support beams beneath the platform. These, like the beams crossing overhead and those rising out of the platform to mate with the overheads, included devices resembling huge automobile shock absorbers. She read in science magazines of the period about the work being done to earthquake-proof skyscrapers and public buildings. Indeed, it seemed as if this platform that formed the living and working area within the bunker was constructed to withstand all but direct collapse of the granite cave surrounding them, regardless of what the earth beneath them should do. She looked back along the platform. Sarah could see, very well defined, the partitioned-off living quarters, office space, storage areas, lots of storage, and the like. The young German officer who delivered them to the bunker explained the process of using lasers to cut space from the bowels of the living rock. The vast storage chambers held food, water, medical supplies, weapons, and ammunition, everything necessary to survive for a long time without ever returning to the surface. Air scrubbers, as well as a small greenhouse area under artificial lights, kept the oxygen supply fresh. It was very much like the retreat, she suddenly realized, and maybe that was why she shivered here. Rourke pulled on the trouser portion of the one-piece dry suit. He already wore the black mid-wake surface suit beneath it. The J-7V flew toward the coast. In less than 15 minutes, they would bail out, joining personnel already on the ground. Rourke stood up. Taking the double Alessi shoulder rig with its twin stainless detonix pistols from the seat beside him, he shouldered into it. The little stainless autoloaders were chamber empty now, as was his custom with a Colt Browning-style auto during an airdrop. Without removing the guns from the leather, one at a time, he pulled the magazines, checked that they each carried 6 rounds, then reinserted them. Clipped into one of the pockets of the surface suit was the little A.G. Russell Sting 1A black chrome. Rourke now pulled the dry suit the rest of the way up, over the surface suit's integral SAS-style leg holster. One of the detonic scoremasters was secured there. The second scoremaster sat tight in a water and pressure-proof pouch in the small pack he would don with his underwater gear. No room this time for his revolver. He needed the extra room for spare magazines. John pulled the dry suit all the way up, closed it at his throat, and rolled over the collar. Around his waist, he secured the mid-wake issue combat belt, holding a Soviet Stai 20 dart gun on one side, his fighting knife on the other. Various medical and survival and repair pouches hung across the back and front. He carried his Crane Life Support System 10 knife with the 12-inch blade in a midway crafted sheath. The sheath was made from the same material as those Darkwood and the other midway personnel used for their own knives. Many of their custom knives resembled his own. Darkwood's knife was of particular interest to John. A duplicate of the Randall Smithsonian Bowie, Darkwood's ancestor brought to Midway 5 centuries ago, Jason commissioned the craftsman to reproduce the original on display at the new Smithsonian at Midway, down to the last detail. Rourke looked across to the opposite side of the fuselage, where Paul and Michael geared up. Each checked the other's equipment. As Rourke prepared his, Jason Darkwood came up.
We can check each other, Doctor?
Fine.
Darkwood nodded, picking up Rourke's kit.
I know this works in theory, but frankly, jumping out of one of these flying machines scares the shit out of me.
Well, it's never something one becomes used to, Jason. Parachuting can be fun when the purpose is fun, but when one's bailing out into combat, there can be more serious considerations.
Rourke smiled.
The enemy can always shoot you out of the sky.
Oh, boy.
Rourke looked at him over his shoulder.
I suppose you're as at home falling through the sky as I am underwater.
Mm-hmm.
Rourke shrugged his shoulders to better settle his harness. The parachutes were jury-rigged by the Germans to accommodate the necessity to quickly, almost instantly, move out underwater. Because of that, the standard German parachute harnesses were coupled to the standard mid-wake underwater gear. The parachute packs would quickly separate to compensate for negative buoyancy, so the discarded chute and attendant packs would sink to the bottom as fast as possible. The individual components were as tested and reliable as could be possible for battle gear, but they had never been used in tandem.
Your wing seems secure. Is everybody certain the covering will break away when we drop the parachutes?
Theoretically.
Yes, theoretically.
They stood by the open fuselage door. Rourke looked down the line behind him. Paul, Michael, Darkwood, Aldridge, Han Lu Chen of the First Chinese City, Otto Hammerschmidt. There were 10 other men, 5 of them, like Hammerschmidt, German long-range mountain patrol or commando, the remaining 5 United States Marine Corps from Midway. Of the 16 men waiting in the doorway behind John Rourke, aside from Rourke himself, only Hammerschmidt and his five men were experienced jumpers, and only Rourke among them ever bailed out over water. Rourke held to the straps and leaned out a little to peer through the open fuselage doorway. The cloud layer through which they flew parted here and there. Beneath that, the ocean far below seemed still. But unless the German intelligence data was wrong, beneath the surface lay an undisclosed number of island-class submarines of the Soviet fleet. Soon those vessels would launch their missiles against the capital of New Germany, and a Fourth World War would begin in earnest. Or the Third World War would end.